Go ahead and open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 5. Verse number 10 is where we're going to pick up the story in a moment. First, let's do a real quick review. The Israelites crossed over the Jordan River on dry ground, thanks to the miraculous intervention of God, holding back the waters of the Jordan at just the precise timing to allow the Ark of the Covenant priests to walk in and the waters disappear, and then to walk out and the waters reappear into their flood zone. It would have taken several hours for the Israelites to get everybody across, but they do. And then they go up away from the floodplain to a place where they're now going to encamp for a while, a place that gets the name Gilgal. So all of that happened on the 10th day of the first month of the 41st year of the Exodus. By my chronology, that puts it right around the middle of April in 1416 BC. That is the day on which they would have also designated the lambs that will be used for Passover in four more days. But they ran into a problem that they are now in the Promised Land, but many of the males were not circumcised by their families during the wilderness experience. Their moms and dads were part of that generation that got in trouble with God, and for whatever reason, they had not bothered to do the covenant circumcision. So that is all resolved on this 10th day, the first day of their arrival in the Promised Land. And they name the place first the Hill of the Foreskins, because there's just so much of this surgery happening. But God refers to it as the rolling away of your reproach. That is the idea that you didn't circumcise your young men in accordance with the Abrahamic covenant, but now we've rolled that away from you. And that word in Hebrew is Gilgal. So this is the community of Gilgal at this point. And I want you to keep in mind that it's probably about 4 miles from the Gilgal encampment to the walls of Jericho. 4 miles, maybe a little bit less than that. So the people in Jericho can clearly see now the tower of shining cloud by day and the blazing fire at night. It's unmistakable. It is, you can't miss it. And so now the Israelites pause again because they have to have a few days to heal up from the surgery that's involved with the circumcision. And then they're going to go into the first celebration of Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread inside the Promised Land. And so that's going to also be an important appointment that they want to keep before they do anything about taking the land from the Canaanites. Joshua 5:10. While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. Now, the plains of Jericho are easily defined because there is a wadi to the north of Jericho. Remember, a wadi is a wet weather stream. It cuts a really nice gully into the terrain. So there's this wadi that comes out of the hills of central Canaan and dumps into the Jordan River. That's on the north. There's another wadi on the south, and the wadis are roughly 3 to 4 miles apart from one another. And so that area between them is called the Plains of Jericho. And at this time in history, the Plains of Jericho would have been filled, jam-packed with agricultural fields, irrigated fields of wheat and barley. and other types of grain and flax. And they would have also had lots of pomegranate and fig tree plantations all through this region. So it is an exceptionally fruitful area of the Promised Land. And the Israelis are right now encamped probably just at the eastern end of that green zone. While Jericho, the city of Jericho, the walled city of Jericho, is almost at the opposite end of the plains of Jericho, close to the base of the uprise to the central hilly area of Canaan. And the Israelis take the sheep, the lambs, that they'd set aside on the day they crossed, the day that they had the mass circumcision, and they butcher those Passover lambs on the afternoon of the 14th, and they begin eating the Passover meal, which takes them past sunset into the 15th day of the first month of the 41st year of the Exodus. And that is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So Passover slides straight into the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, verse number 11, listen to this. The day after the Passover, on that very day, and by the way, the Passover in this particular year fell on a Sabbath day. The 14th began Friday at sunset and ended at Saturday at sunset. So the whole 14th was the day set aside for rest anyway. The following day, therefore, would have been a Sunday, the 15th. It starts in the evening, Saturday night when the sun goes down, and it'll finish on Sunday evening when the sun goes down. So that's the 15th, the day after the Passover, which would have also, therefore, been the Feast of First Fruits. Now, this is significant because the way that the Feast of First Fruits was supposed to work is that the first day of the week that fell during Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread, the high priest was supposed to go out into the ripening grain fields, specifically the barley fields, because that's what ripens first among the grain stock. And he was supposed to cut a sheaf of this barley and then take it into the tabernacle and wave it in front of God's holy presence, his Ark of the Covenant. And by this action, he devoted the first fruits of the barley harvest to God. And this then marked the beginning of the people's permission to eat barley grain from that year's growth. Now, we know that they would not have started harvesting barley on this day because the first day of Unleavened Bread, the 15th, was always a day off of work. But that did not stop them from eating from that, just as not a harvest, but rather just taking enough to eat for a meal. So verse number 11 says, the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. So the 15th day of the first month of the 41st year, just a few days after they moved into the Promised Land, Israelis ate barley that had been planted by Canaanites. And this is the beginning now of their occupation of the Promised Land. And this is where verse 12 kicks in. The manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. So on the 16th, when they got up in the morning, there was no manna on the ground. That probably came as a great big shock to them because they've been living off this manna for 40 years. They've gotten into the habit of getting up every morning, Sabbath days excepting, and going out and collecting one day's ration of manna for every person in their household. That had happened for the 11th day of the month, because that was the day after they came in, and it happened again on the 12th day of the month, and the 13th day of the month, they would have had the double portion, because the 14th was a Sabbath. And then when they got up on the 16th, on the morning of the 15th, there was the manna again. But now it stops. The 16th, it's gone, and it won't be back because they have started having the opportunity to gather the grain planted by the Canaanites, and that's exactly what they do. At first, it's making sure that they've got enough for each day's work, but probably as time moves forward, they start getting in large harvesting parties up and down the Jordan Valley that they are now in to make sure that they're laying in all of that year's barley harvest into storage for themselves. All right, so that's what's happening now for the Israelis in the end of the first month of the first Jewish year in the Promised Land. Okay. The Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread finishes up on the 22nd. And my guess is that the Israelis enjoyed that week off and started getting used to the idea that we're going to have to gather the grain for ourselves now because the manna is no longer part of our lives. Once that's finished, and we come to the 23rd day of the month, which, by the way, would be a Sunday going into a Monday. That's when they can start thinking about going against Jericho. So verse 13, somewhere in that last week, probably, of the first month of the Jewish people, Joshua was by Jericho. So he goes just a few miles, just walks over a few miles, and gets up where he can kind of see up close the walls. And remember, I described to you what the walls probably look like. There was a retaining wall at the bottom that went all the way around the raised platform of this tell. And then above that retaining wall, there was a mud brick wall that went up and protected the lower city, the lower slope. There would have been some sort of gate system going up into this city. And then there was another mud brick wall up high that ringed around the very top of this mound. And that would be where the centralmost city was. That's the high city, probably where the better off people and the king of Jericho lived, inside that higher city. So he's up here looking at the city and perhaps pondering how it's going to be taken. And he lifted up his eyes and he looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. So he's looking at the city, and then suddenly he notices there's some guy there with an unsheathed sword. And that bothers him, and he does what a good military person does. Are you friend or foe? And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or for our adversaries? Friend or foe? And he said, no. Or perhaps we would put it in our way of saying, neither one. But I am the commander of the army of he who is, and now I have come. So this personage that looks like a man, identifies himself as the commander of the army of God, the heavenly army of God. And so Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped him and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the wording here is not the divine name. It is, "What does my master say to his servant?" Now, the falling down and worshiping here, this is where we have to kind of tackle a topic that we don't really have enough detail on in a lot of different places where it comes up. And that is the idea of, when is the angel of the Lord actually God himself appearing? Because we know sometimes he does. Other times, it's just his angel representing him like any servant does, and even speaking in the first person. That's a thing that we see in Bible time, is if somebody were speaking on behalf of their master, they use the first person language, because they're effectively just repeating what their master said. I like to sometimes use this idea of, if a phone rings and you listen to it for a moment and then you hold it out to somebody and say, "Here, it's your mom," they're going to not think you're being weird saying that the phone is your mom, but rather that the phone is delivering the voice of your mom, providing the message directly from your mom. So that's the way messengers worked in the old world, in the ancient time. And angels are just messengers of God. So the reason I bring all that up is because it's possible that this is just the angel messenger of the Lord. Perhaps somebody like Michael, who we see in the book of Daniel, is the angel assigned by God to the Jewish people. Gabriel is another messenger of God that plays a significant role with the Israeli people, particularly with matters involved with the Messiah. So it's possible this is just Michael the archangel or some other angel representing God's interests in what's about to happen to Jericho. That being said, it is interesting that the word for worship is used in this context. And when Joshua falls down in that fashion, the person doesn't say back, "Don't do that. I'm just a servant of God like you," which we do see happen in certain places where angels appear. And if that's the case, that this is genuine divine type of worship that Joshua is offering, and it's not called down, then this may in fact be God the Father or God the Son or God the Holy Spirit taking human visible form and appearing to Joshua here. But then again, see, I can't let you just assume one way or the other here. It's possible that the word worship here just simply means falling down in respect, like you would for anyone who is superior to you. And definitely, the commander, even the angelic commander of the Lord's angelic army, outranks Joshua. And he would feel the need to show that superiority. So, I gotta be honest, I don't know. I don't know if this is a theophany, that is an appearance of God in human form, or a Christophany, an appearance of Jesus in human form before Bethlehem, or if it's just an angel. Ultimately, it won't matter because the message is coming straight from God. Verse 15, "The commander of he who is his army said to Joshua, 'Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy.' And Joshua did so." And some people point to that and say, aha, that's exactly what God said to Moses on Mount Sinai when he appeared to him there. Yes, but it could also just be the fact that this is the angel of God that is bringing God's direct message that would make the place holy. So I am not totally convinced even by that, that the matter is settled. But Joshua gets instructions now about how he is to take Jericho. It is not going to be by a direct assault. God is going to demonstrate his power in taking any city. Chapter 6. Now Jericho was shut up inside and out because of the people of Israel. None went in, none came out. And it's probably been like that for 10 days or more. He who is said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor." And that's probably the majority of people that are left is military members. Because as we've talked about before, the people of the land are melting away. They are fleeing away from any place where the Israelis might be going next. Very typical in a zone that's about to come under any type of warfare. Here comes the instructions. "You shall march around the city, all the men of the war going around the city once. Thus you shall do for 6 days." So if Joshua is getting these instructions, perhaps on a Sabbath day, then, or some, maybe the first day of the week, so that marching time finishes with the last day being a first day of the week, then tomorrow is going to be the first day that he takes his troops to march around the city once. Verse 4, "Seven priests shall bear trumpets of ram's horns before the ark." This is the shofar. "On the seventh day, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow trumpets." Now that makes me wonder if perhaps the seventh day of Jericho is the first day of the next week. Because they're going to have a Sabbath day rest where they only march around once on the day before that. That's my guess. Verse 5, "When they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." So the plan of attack, so to speak, 6 days, once around. No sounds other than trumpets blowing. Seventh day, 7 times around, no sound but the trumpets blowing until they finish the 7th time around, and then everybody is to shout. And it's at that point that the walls that I described about, the mud brick walls, are going to collapse. And as they do so, they're going to make ramps that go up first into the lower city and then from there into the upper city, so that the Israelis can walk straight up into the city from all different directions. And that's what the archaeology shows, by the way, is that those mud brick walls fell straight down. Verse number six. "So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, 'Take up the Ark of the Covenant and let 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horn before the Ark of He Who Is.' And he said to the people, 'Go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the Ark of He Who Is.' And just as Joshua had commanded the people, the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before He Who Is went up forward, blowing the trumpets with the Ark of the Covenant of He Who Is following them. And the armed men were walking before the priests who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard were walking after the ark while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, "You shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout, and then you shall shout." So their instruction is absolute silence in the march. So they leave the encampment at Gilgal. They march the couple of miles, few miles, that goes up to the city of Jericho. Then they march around. First, a vanguard. Perhaps we've got the 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and half-tribe Manasseh. They're in that front. But they march silently around with the trumpeters blowing trumpets right behind them, with the Ark of the Covenant behind them, and then the rest of the armies behind the Ark of the Covenant. So they encircle it. If they leave a couple of hundred yards of safety away from the walls so that bows and arrows can't be used against them, then we're talking about a circuit of about 1.5 miles or so. That's not going to take very long. They can be up to Jericho and around it and back to Gilgal in a matter of a few hours. Verse number 11. So he caused the ark of He Who Is to circle the city, going about it once. And they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. So that's the first day. Up, around, back again. Nothing. Joshua rose early in the morning. The priest took up the ark of He Who Is. The seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Covenant walked on. They blew the trumpets continually, and the armed men were walking before them, and the rear guard were walking after the Ark of the Covenant while the trumpets blew continually. The second day they marched around the city once, returned into the camp, and so they did it for 6 days. And you know that the people in Jericho are definitely wondering what's up. They're not being attacked. They're just being circled by these silent marchers.